Before we start the show today, we would like to acknowledge and pay respect to the traditional custodians of the land on which Usid stands, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. As we share, explore, and celebrate Sydney through this podcast, we also pay respect and celebrate the knowledge embedded forever within the Aboriginal custodianship of country. Sovereignty was never ceded, always was, always will be Aboriginal land. Welcome back, everyone. Welcome to Footnotes. We are happy to see you again, and we hope you enjoyed our last career series on the clerkship process. But today, we've got something a little bit different. We're going to be looking at criminal law today, specifically the Bail Act reforms that have just happened. But before that, my name's Tamsin.
And I'm Brandon.
And we would just like to thank Surge for letting us use their studio before we get into the podcast. Right, so what's happened recently is in June of this year, we had some reforms to the Bail Act, specifically Section 22B, subsection 1. So what happened was a few newspapers campaigned for the reforms in a series of articles criticising bail decisions where people were convicted of child sexual assault and were granted bail before their actual sentence was imposed. And so the coalition passed these reforms intending to make it harder for convicted child sex offenders to walk free before sentencing. And it includes a provision for bail to be refused where a person convicted of a crime for which they will serve a sentence of imprisonment. Specifically, Section 22B, subsection 1 stipulates that during the period following conviction and before sentencing for an offence for which the accused person will be sentenced to imprisonment to be served by a full-time detention, a court, and under subparagraph A, on a release application made by the accused person, must not grant bail or dispense with bail unless it is established that special or exceptional circumstances exist that justify the decision, or under subparagraph B, on a detention application made in relation to the accused person, must refuse bail unless it is established that special or exceptional circumstances exist that justify the decision. And specifically, that use of the word will has created a few issues regarding statutory interpretation, which, Brandon, you are all over.
Yes, I am, Tamsin. One of the first cases to deal with this was the case of Day, which was a detention application being sought against Titus Day, who was the former manager of musician Guy Sebastian. Now, in the main case, Mr. Day had already been convicted on embezzlement offences. And in the Supreme Court, Justice Garling went through the principles of statutory construction to determine what was the legislative intent and concluded that that word will meant that the court had to find on the balance of probabilities that there were no other alternatives than full-time imprisonment that could lawfully be imposed by a sentencing court. Now, in that case, it was actually found that the detention application did not succeed, so Mr. Day was allowed to continue at liberty in the community. However, that test of will that Justice Garling spoke about in Day was modified by Van Gestel, which was heard after Day and in the Court of Criminal Appeal. It was also a detention application where in the main case, a man was convicted of sexual misconduct against a child, one of the offences that the media was outraged by in the first place. Now, the court refined how, as Tamsin mentioned, Section 22, capital B, subsection 1 would be interpreted to give it a meaning that made it more realistic in application. And in that case, bail was revoked after having previously been granted. Joining us today is the Honourable Justice Geoffrey Bellew. Justice Bellew has been a judge of the Supreme Court of New South Wales for over a decade now and was one of the first judges to hear an application that concerned the new provisions that were added to the Bail Act back in June.
We hope you guys enjoy. Thank you everyone for listening to Footnotes and for listening to our episode on the Bail Act reforms. I'm lucky enough to be sitting down with the Honourable Justice Geoffrey Bellew of the Supreme Court. Justice Bellew, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hello, Tamsin. It's very nice to be with you.
Thank you. Would you like to tell everyone what division you're in the Supreme Court and what you mostly do?
I'm a judge of the Common Law Division of the Court, and I have been for almost 11 years. Work of the Common Law Division is quite varied, but it does take up all of the court's criminal work, which is basically murder trials, terrorism trials, and also dealing with release applications under the Bail Act. And I also sit quite a bit in the Court of Criminal Appeal.
Yeah, and prior to becoming a judge, you were also an SC and you did a lot of crime work there, didn't you?
I did. I was at the bar for 20 years. The last five of those years were as senior counsel. And for the entirety of my career at the bar, I did predominantly criminal work, a lot of which was for the Commonwealth Director of Public Prosecutions. And I prosecuted a range of criminal offences, including terrorism offences, taxation frauds, revenue frauds, drug importation cases and the like.
And you've been sitting on a few of these new bail applications since the reforms have been introduced, haven't you?
I have. I've done a couple of them. They were, I think, the first two that were brought in the Supreme Court, although for a variety of reasons that I don't need to go into, a couple of applications that came after mine, in those cases the reasons were published before mine, but I've done two. Another judge of the division has done a couple, and recently the Court of Criminal Appeal has looked at these provisions as well.
How recently?
In the last couple of weeks.
Starting off, the matter of Duncan that you sat on, for a first year like me trying to understand it, it was quite, I found, theoretically complex because it was dealing with the application of fresh reforms and also the process of statutory construction. And there were references to the Acts Interpretation Act, which as a first year who hasn't taken civil and criminal procedure, I knew nothing about. Can you please explain your decision in that matter in layman's terms?
All right. Well, as briefly and as simply as I can put it, there were three issues raised in the course of that application. The first issue that was raised was whether or not the legislation, by the legislation I mean Section 22 capital B of the Bail Act, offended the common law principle of retrospectivity. I won't go into that. The end result was that I found that, properly construed, the legislation was not retrospective. The second issue was this question of whether or not the offender in that case will be sentenced to a term of imprisonment. Given the nature of the offending against him, I was satisfied that that test had been met. The third issue was whether or not there were special or exceptional circumstances which justified the offender being at liberty pending his sentence. Now, there was evidence in that case that the offender had recently been diagnosed with prostate cancer. There was also some suggestion, subject to further medical tests, that he may also be suffering from bowel cancer. He had a scheduled operation in respect of his prostate cancer, and a combination of those factors were advanced as a justification for a finding that there were special or exceptional circumstances. Now, the significant thing about that issue was that the Crown prosecutor, senior counsel for the Crown, expressly conceded that those factors amounted to special or exceptional circumstances. And acting on that concession, I came to the conclusion that the Crown's detention application should fail. Interestingly, the matter has since been back before the sentencing judge, and the sentencing judge has adjourned the sentence proceedings until after that offender has undergone his upcoming surgery so that there can be a proper assessment made of the nature and extent of his condition, perhaps the effect it might have on its life, on his life expectancy, matters of that nature, all of which will have a bearing ultimately on the sentence which is imposed.
So in the introduction, I gave a brief outline of the reforms. That also came from the perspective of a first year who has taken foundations of law and nothing else, if you don't count my 2 weeks of torts. Can you please give me a more detailed outline as to the reforms?
The reforms came about as a consequence of a number of victims of sexual offending expressing concerns that sexual offenders, having been found guilty by a jury or by a judge, were allowed to be at liberty pending their sentence in circumstances where it was suggested that because of the serious nature of their offending, it was essentially inevitable that they would be sent to jail. There were sections of the media who supported that. There were representations made to the government. The government looked at it, and as a consequence, Section 22B was enacted. I think the important aspect of Section 22B is that although it makes reference to a person being sentenced to a term of full-time imprisonment, quite often, and the Duncan case was one example, the court who is asked to apply Section 22B won't be the sentencing court. It's also the case, and again, Duncan's case is an example, that I didn't have all of the materials that are going to be relied upon for the purposes of his sentence. So when the section talks about the person will be sentenced to full-time imprisonment, the Court of Criminal Appeal in the case of Van Gestel has recently said that the use of the word will indicates a future likelihood and suggests what is reasonably inevitable as distinct from what may happen or is likely to happen, but it doesn't involve a state of absolute certainty.
When I was doing research for this episode, I came across a judgment by His Honour Peter Garling that the word will almost like connotates a degree of certainty or confidence. Has it now been found by the Court of Criminal Appeal that in the construction of the statute, the word will is not connotating that? It's more a likelihood?
I think the matter's now been refined somewhat by the Court of Criminal Appeal, and that court has come to the conclusion, as I said a moment ago, that the use of the word will indicates a future likelihood. Mm-hmm. It suggests what is realistically inevitable as distinct from what may happen or is likely to happen, but it does not involve a state of absolute certainty. Yeah. That's where the law stands in relation to that issue at the moment.
Yeah. And you mentioned that when you were giving an introduction as to these reforms, that there was influence by the media. I noticed that the Premier Dominic Perrottet promised to change the laws while on air with Ray Hadley. What would you say this demonstrates about the role of the media in prosecuting law reforms?
I don't think it demonstrates anything that's new. It is not uncommon for certain sections of the media to support members of the public in their endeavours to have the law changed. I read recently where there is a group of people who are victims or who are close to victims of dangerous driving cases who are presenting or seeking to present reforms to the government about the sentencing regime that is imposed in those sorts of cases. Now, ultimately, it's a matter for the government, mm-hmm. whether or not the government thinks that a reform is worthy or not worthy. In this case, the government came to the conclusion that a reform was warranted and Section 22B was enacted. But I don't think there's anything unusual about the media supporting certain causes that are sought to be pursued by members of the public. Yeah. They certainly did so in this case. But ultimately, of course, it's a matter for the government as to whether or not they act on representations that are made to them.
Something interesting about these reforms is that they were enacted in order to deal with sex offences, particularly against children, I believe. But interestingly, the use of the word will, I think, led to contradictory outcomes initially.
I'm not sure that led to contradictory outcomes. Certainly, the thrust of the reforms that were sought was sought by those who were victims of sexual offending. However, it's important to bear in mind that these reforms apply across the board.
Yeah.
They don't just apply to convicted sex offenders. They apply to any person who has been convicted or found guilty and who will, in the sense that I've already explained it, be sentenced to a term of full-time imprisonment.
Right. And you noted that in the matter of Duncan, there was an issue of retrospectivity that you didn't need to decide in that circumstance.
Well, I actually did need to decide it, and, okay. I did. It was raised squarely.
It wasn't something you didn't decide. It was something that wasn't persuasive to the court necessarily.
Correct.
Okay, sorry, my mistake. Are you able to go into what was claimed in that circumstance, even though it was decided that it didn't apply and why it didn't apply?
Basically, senior counsel for Mr. Duncan in that case made a submission that on its proper construction, Section 22 capital B of the Act contravened what is referred to as the common law presumption against retrospectivity. Mm-hmm. He submitted that at common law, a statute changing the law shouldn't, unless there was a clearly expressed contrary intention, be understood as applying to facts or events that had already occurred in a way that affected a person's rights or liabilities. And he submitted that the common law presumption against retrospectivity applied because Section 22B substantially increased an offender's exposure, for want of a better term, to imprisonment. I came to the conclusion that that submission should be rejected. And basically, in coming to that conclusion, I drew a distinction by reference to some authorities between legislation that has a prior effect on past events, which is retrospective, and legislation which bases future action on past events, which is not. And having cited some authorities both within Australia and the United Kingdom, I came to the conclusion that Section 22B did not offend the common law presumption against retrospectivity. I came to the conclusion that the section takes into account antecedent facts or previous facts, namely that a person has been convicted but not sentenced, and uses that as a basis for what it prescribes is to occur in the future, namely that the person is not to be released if he or she will be sentenced to full-time imprisonment if there are no special or exceptional circumstances. And I also came to the conclusion that that approach to the construction of Section 22B didn't involve using Clause 45 of the regulation as an aid. And I pointed out that Clause 45 of the bail regulation simply confirmed that Section 22B applied whether or not the application was made before or after the commencement of that section.
So it's not retrospective because it's not applying a new rule to past events. That would obviously offend the rule of rule principle of like predictability and consistency, I guess you could also make that argument, and also the common law principle of against retrospectivity. It's simply you're taking past occurrences into account when making a decision.
Well, what you're doing is taking past occurrences into account, and in this case what you're taking the past occurrence is the person's been convicted and not sentenced, and you're using that as a basis to determine what should happen in the future. That's not retrospective. And there is a common law presumption against retrospectivity. That is not to say that governments cannot enact legislation which is retrospective. They can, providing they make it clear that that is what they're intending to do. There were instances going back to the 80s where they had taxation schemes called bottom of the harbour taxation schemes, which on one view were valid at the time that perhaps that they were being entered into. The government enacted legislation to retrospectively render those sorts of schemes unlawful. So you can do it, but in this case it just didn't arise because of its nature, it wasn't retrospective.
If a retrospective piece of legislation came to a court and the court had to decide on it, if it offended a common law principle, is the court justified in saying it would lead to an absurd result and constructing the statute in a different way?
Well, perhaps. That's a question that involves a number of parts and perhaps a number of assumptions. But certainly what I can say is that it is a principle of statutory interpretation that when a court is called upon to determine the meaning of a statute, one principle that it applies is that a result or a construction that is consistent with the overall scheme of the legislation and the object of the legislation is to be preferred to one that's not. And secondly, if a construction brings about an absurd result, then as a general proposition, one should perhaps infer that that is not what the Parliament intended.
Moving on from statutory interpretation slightly, a barrister, Mr. Stephen Lawrence, said that these reforms have had, quote, a significant effect on criminal cases, with many detention applications being made. From your experience, do you see these reforms exacerbating the resource strain that the courts are already experiencing due to the pandemic?
I'm not sure that the effect of it is going to be that marked. There have certainly been a number of applications brought in recent weeks. I have another one listed before me this week. So certainly there have been a number of them. Whether or not they're putting a significant strain on the court, that's probably putting it a little high. But certainly there's been a proliferation of applications, as one would have expected.
And another issue that was brought up is that the lack of procedural safeguards within lower courts may lead to this provision's misuse. Do you agree, and can you, if you do, can you explain how that would occur?
I'm not sure that I would use the term misuse.
Okay.
Because detention applications of this nature are brought by the Director of Public Prosecutions. It would certainly be unusual, to say the least, that the Office of the Director would misuse a power of that kind. So I certainly wouldn't suggest in any way that the power is being misused. There was a submission put to me in another of these cases that I did, which was a case of the Queen and AP, where it was suggested that the director had incorrectly exercised the power to bring the application. Certainly in that case, I rejected that argument. What the effect of the amendments might be in terms of the progress of matters, particularly in the local court and the district court, remains to be seen. There is some suggestion from practitioners at those levels that the reforms are going to cause delays in the progression of matters in those courts. Frankly, I simply don't know whether or not that is going to be the case. It's a matter, I think, of just waiting and seeing. One won't know the effects of these sorts of reforms on the progress of matters probably for 12 months or so. There's certainly some suggestions that that is going to be the, or an effect. Whether or not that proves to be the case, I think, remains to be seen.
Okay. Do you see these reforms having the potential to discourage early and appropriate guilty pleas, as it's been raised a couple of times?
Well, again, that has been the suggestion. I have spoken to a number of people I know who practice in the local court and in the district court, and who have suggested to me in conversation that they can see effects happening already where people are reluctant to plead guilty at an early opportunity for fear that they're going to be taken into custody immediately. Again, whether or not that ultimately proves to be a valid complaint and whether it proves to be a matter that impacts upon the conduct of criminal matters in the local court and the district court remains to be seen. For the reasons that I alluded to a moment ago, I don't think we'll be in a position to really make any sort of sensible determination of whether that's right or wrong for some time.
Could you please go into a little bit more detail about how this could potentially discourage early guilty pleas? Like, what mechanisms of the legislation could lead to that result?
Well, the suggestion has been made to me that people will be reluctant to enter pleas because they want to be at liberty between the time that they enter their plea of guilty and the time that they're sentenced. They want to be at large for the purposes of organising their personal affairs before they're taken into custody, and the suggestion that they won't be able to do that will result in them being reluctant to enter a plea of guilty. As I say, one just can't determine that. One also has to bear in mind that there are certain benefits, statutory benefits, to those who plead guilty at an early stage. Yeah. So those factors have to be taken into consideration as well in determining, or in an offender determining, whether or not he or she will enter a plea of guilty. That's the basis on which it's been put to me that there may be some delays as a consequence of the introduction of Section 22 capital B. As I've said, it's impossible to determine at the moment whether that's realistic or not. Mm-hmm. I will say that the practitioners who have expressed that view to me are very experienced practitioners in the criminal law, both in the local court and the district court. They're the sort of practitioners who, when they make observations of that nature, you tend to sit up and take notice because of their experience. But often one envisages results of legislative reform such as this. Sometimes those results don't manifest themselves.
On that last point that you just made, Justice Garling cited a view that the legislation involved an infelicity of drafting. Do you have any comments to make on this?
Look, I wouldn't want to make any comment about His Honour's observation in a forum like this, nor would I want to express my own personal opinion about whether or not there is an infelicity of drafting evident in Section 22 capital B. To the extent that I would make observations of that nature, I would do so in a judgment, but perhaps not in a forum like this. I did make some observations in the judgment in Duncan about the potential difficulties that a court faces in an application like this, where the court who's asked to make a determination under Section 22 capital B is not the sentencing court. I think that demonstrates that these reforms are not straightforward. I would also certainly accept that legislation that is rushed through can, in some circumstances, lead to infelicity of language, although I make it clear that I'm not suggesting that that happened in this case.
So, as a first-year law student, something that I understood Bales to sort of include as a prerequisite was the presumption of innocence. And in this case, because of the new legislation, we've seen people who have been convicted be granted bail. Do you think that that is sort of almost leading to an inconsistency between the common law principle of the presumption of innocence and these decisions?
No, I don't think there's any inconsistency at all, because in cases to which Section 22 capital B applies, the person has been convicted. So whilst the person enjoyed the presumption of innocence to begin with, the conviction has resulted in that presumption being removed. I will say, however, this, that Section 22 capital B aside, when a person is charged with a criminal offence, he or she, as we direct juries in trials, is presumed innocent until such time as the Crown has proved their guilt beyond reasonable doubt. That creates a real conundrum, which, combined with a whole lot of other factors, makes bail applications one of the hardest determinations that a judge has to make, because a person is presumed innocent. They come before the court entitled to rely on that presumption, and then the court has to make an assessment of the strength of the case and risks and matters of that nature, all on the basis of documents, and then make a determination as to whether or not the person should be released. When people ask me what is the hardest part about my job, bails is always at the forefront of that answer, particularly in circumstances where, if a person is refused bail, they are likely to spend a very long period of time in custody before such time as they get to their trial. So, no, I don't think that there's any incursion, as it were, on the presumption of innocence by Section 22B, because it's relating to a completely different situation where the presumption has been removed. But I do stress that the presumption of innocence is a very important factor that one has to take into account when determining whether or not a person should be released on bail.
Separate from the act in itself involving an incursion on the presumption of innocence, because you've been found guilty and almost forfeited that presumption for that matter, do you think that, because the Bail Act includes show cause requirements for some indictable offences, for which you are still presumed innocent, and the fact that people who are convicted are being granted bail because these new legislations are creating a sort of broader inconsistency about who is getting bail, who isn't?
No, I don't think so. Okay. I don't think there's any inconsistency. The show cause provisions apply, as you've said, to certain types of offences. And, of course, the show cause provisions are separate and distinct from the test that you have to apply in terms of a risk. So, no, I don't think there's any issue there.
Justice Bellew, thank you for your time. Is there any advice that you would like to leave these young budding law students with?
No, just work hard. And if anybody tells you at the end of your studies that there are no jobs available for lawyers, don't believe them. I was told that 46 years ago when I finished high school. I was told that if I studied law, the job market was so bad that I would end up driving a taxi. That thankfully didn't happen. So when people suggest to you that you'll never get a job, don't believe them. Is the job market tough? Yes, it is. But there will always be a place in the profession for young, hard-working, industrious lawyers.
Thank you, Justin.
That wraps up this episode of Footnotes. Thank you all so much for listening, and a big thank you to the Honourable Justice Bellew for being our guest on this episode and giving up time from his busy schedule to be interviewed. And thank you to Surge for allowing us to record this episode in their studio. A shout out also to the 2022 Footnotes team, Nick, Veronica, you, Tamsin, myself, Executive Producer Jacinda, and the Publications Director, Ariana.
Until our next episode, don't forget to follow the Souls socials. It is at Souls_Sydney on Instagram and the Sydney University Law Society on Facebook. Thank you guys so much again for listening, and we will see you in the next episode.